Toxin.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In January 2009, Dr. Ronald Carter drove through Charlotte's Center City. He had just been named president of Johnson C. Smith University and had heard good things about Charlotte's growth and its position as an exciting, progressive southern city. His drive through uptown, he says, reaffirmed that reputation. Let me quote what he says about what happened next. Then, he says, we drove under the I-77 bridge on North Tryon Street, came up to Five Points, and proceeded down Beatty's Ford Road, also known as the Northwest Corridor. I thought I had entered another world. It wasn't a gradual decline, but rather an abrupt and dramatic demarcation between the city's haves and have-nots. That is from the foreword that Dr. Carter wrote for a book about Charlotte's West Side called Let There Be Light. The book was his idea, and he was able to encourage journalists, historians, civic leaders, and others to contribute essays about this part of town, about its history, its challenges, its contributions, and the dreams people have for its future. It is indisputable that Charlotte's West Side has languished even as other parts of town have flourished. The hope is that this book will be the beginning of a course correction to a brighter future. And we're joined this hour by several of those folks who have contributed to the book. Tom Henchett is the historian at the Levine Museum of the New South. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Mary Newsom is Associate Director of Urban and Regional Affairs at UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. Thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
And Malcolm Graham is a state senator and special assistant to the president of Johnson C. Smith University, which is on the West Side Corridor, just outside the shadow of downtown. Good to see you again as well.
Pleasure to be here.
Tom, let's talk about some history. Let's begin with some history. As Charlotte grew from its central core, which I guess the square is the central core of it all, in which direction did it grow first? Did it grow to the east and the south, or did it grow to the west at the same time in the north?
The early growth is kind of wherever somebody wanted to plant an institution outside of the immediate center city, what's now the center city. And one of the first institutions planted outside was what's now Johnson C. Smith University, Biddle Institute.
Really?
Which was started right after the Civil War. Presbyterian leaders said, we have this whole new freed population. We need leaders. We need preachers and teachers.
You know, we had no plantations in this part of the country to speak of.
Few, compared to Charleston or the Low Country.
But I read that right after the Civil War, 40% of the population of Charlotte was African American.
That's true.
Wow. Who knew?
And most of them were worked on small farms rather than large plantations. But here, as in other places, there was a move away from the farm to the city, because the city means freedom, the city means possibility, the city means opportunity. And Biddle Institute became an important part of that. One way you can see that today, if you drive anywhere west of the center city, look for the brick spire of Biddle Hall, which was built in the 1880s, the grandest Victorian building that either white or black folk built back then. And it still is a landmark on the west side.
And certainly one of the few that remains
of
that era. Take us through some of the history then of the west side, particularly up the west corridor from Five Points down to Beatty's Ford Road, and then from West Trade as well toward Johnson C. Smith University.
Well, if you go out West Trade Street, you go under the I-77 bridge, and that was created about half a century ago and became a real barrier. Before that, there had been black and white and different economic levels on the west side.
So let's talk about that, because urban renewal and interstate highway systems tend to come through the middle of cities and not through the best parts of cities, evidently, because they didn't put it through.
They go through the most politically powerless.
That's right. They didn't go through Myers Park for I-77. But prior to I-77 going down that stretch of land, was West Trade a continuous stretch of neighborhoods and businesses and stores?
It was indeed. There were white neighborhoods and black neighborhoods. Seversville, there was a Seversville school in living memory, and that area The Roswell's Ferry Road were white areas. The black areas were close by Johnson C. Smith University. And as urban renewal wiped out the black neighborhood of Brooklyn and other neighborhoods in the center city, those neighborhoods became more African American.
So I-77 and that bridge that kind of cut everything off went through in 19...
Boy, I used to know that.
The late 60s and the early 70s. I talked to a lady who had to move in 1968 from Greenville neighborhood because the interstate was taking her house.
Okay. So that's when it began. But prior to that, you write in your essay in this book that Biddleville, which is the area around what?
Right around Johnson C. Smith University.
Biddleville and Seversville, both of them welcomed both races.
The Biddleville was more African American. Seversville was more a white neighborhood, mm-hmm. Some of the areas did early on have both black and white residents on the same street. Segregation hardened over the course of the 20th century, and you can see that in the West Side.
And you say it wasn't until after World War II that this area actually would become the quote black side of town,
right.
unquote.
Right.
Why? What made that happen? Why did it happen? And is that also when neglect began?
It's not when neglect began. The unequal opportunities in American society for black and white have been, you can see them expressed in the West Side, but you can also see tremendous striving, tremendous success. One of the surprising neighborhoods just beyond Johnson C. Smith is called McCrory Heights. And H.L. McCrory was the president at Smith who got the Duke Endowment involved, got the Smith family involved, really upped the game of Johnson C. Smith, gave it the new name in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. He really wanted to have an upper-income suburb because African-Americans were prohibited by deed restrictions from living in much of the rest of the city. And so right after World War II, he developed McCrory Heights with patriotic names Patton and Washington. It's a neighborhood sort of like out of Brady Bunch or Leave It to Beaver, where not only professors and ministers lived, but also engineers and executives. The folks in the 50s and 60s who were coming out of G.I. Bill college opportunities, who were coming out of the historically black colleges and white colleges as well, and who became the folks who made the civil rights movement happen in Charlotte. And so many different levels of economic achievement in that area. Some areas you see neglect, some you don't. We do a bus tour with Community Building Initiative called Beyond the Bridge that introduces people who haven't been around that neighborhood to that diversity.
Mary, you also write about the gradual change from neighborhoods of diversity to all black neighborhoods in the 60s and 70s, and you write about some people's personal stories. You interviewed some folks, some of them still live there, as a matter of fact, and they're white. But you say that this gradual change occurred. When it did occur, was it a there goes the neighborhood sort of thing? Were people moving out because African Americans were moving in, or did it just happened? Was it just gravity?
I think it was some of both. I didn't talk to anyone who specifically said, I moved because black people were moving in. Mm-hmm. But I discovered some really interesting articles from the Charlotte Observer and the Charlotte News from the 60s about what they called real estate men who would knock on people's doors and say, you'd better sell your house because the coloreds, they said, are moving in. It was very offensive even to be reading that. But that's what was happening. At the same time, I talked to some people in Wesley Heights. Wesley Heights had been a slightly more upscale white neighborhood. And when urban renewal sent all of these black families who had lost their houses in search of housing, a lot of folks moved to Wesley Heights. But
place Wesley Heights for us.
Thank you. Good reminder. If you'd go out West Trade Street, go under the I-77 bridge and turn left up along Tuckasegee Road, it's Summit Avenue, Grandin Avenue, Walnut Avenue. It's that neighborhood. Okay. Developed by the same guy who developed Eastover later.
Beautiful.
It's a very
bungalows.
Beautiful neighborhood. But there were some white folks that lived there that continued to live there. They liked their neighborhood. They didn't want to move. from what I heard, most people got along well. I think there were some incidents, but to my knowledge, no major screaming demonstrations. It was in some ways sudden and in other places more gradual.
Do we understand, and maybe Malcolm knows too, because, I mean, you're not from here. You're from the Charleston area, but I'm sure having worked on this book and working with Dr. Carter, that you've learned a lot about the West. I've been here a long time now. What were there forces driving this change in population that we haven't talked about yet? Because I'm not sure I understand why, if it was a relatively mixed neighborhood or people, there was no big brouhaha about African Americans moving in and living next door to a white person, why it suddenly became an issue.
Well, the population changed a little bit, and people wanted to be near people that looked like them. And back in that era,
was this pre-civil rights, pre-Martin Luther King, or was it during the same time as that?
Probably during the same time.
Okay,
and you know, and the city became, once the highway came through that side of town, people became separated. While some whites remained, many, many more left. Mm-hmm. And so gradually it became segregated. People wanted to live by people that looked like them, that worked the same places that they went to, that kids went to the same school. So people assimilated to be by people that looked and felt and had the same type of emotional ties to the community that they did.
Tryon Street and Trade Street make up that intersection makes up the four quarters, the four wards
right.
In the downtown area.
Right in the middle.
But officially, what is the West Side? Does it begin at I-77? Does it begin at East and West Boulevard on South Boulevard? Where does it begin?
Well,
the boundaries.
Well, if you talk, and the historian may have a better perspective of that than I do, but from our perspective and for people within the African American community, it's just as you described, is West Boulevard, West Charlotte, the heart of the West community would be West Charlotte High School. People would think that's as ground zero for the West End, but it goes to the airport, et cetera. So mm-hmm. that particular geography.
You mentioned West Charlotte being the heart of it, but you in your essay talk about Johnson C. Smith being the taproot of all of what came into existence after 1870 on that part of town. Why was it so important? Why was the university so important to the development?
Historically, Black College was so special. One of the crimes of slavery was that African Americans were forbidden by law to read and write. And when freedom came, they knew how to better themselves, how to get power. And that's learn and learn and learn. And what's now Johnson C. Smith University started out as basically a prep school, since there hadn't been, you know, elementary, what we now call K-12 education, and it grew itself into a college and then into a university. So, you know, that history was something that people who wanted opportunity, who were striving to better themselves, create a strong community, they would gravitate there. Even early on, before streetcars, people who were ministers in town, for instance, those were some of the best educated folks, some of the folks with the most means. I've found in city directories, they would live around the university in Biddleville, and I imagine walk, or perhaps they would have a carriage or something like that to mm-hmm. get into town. So that's early on. The first streetcars ran out Beatty's Ford Road to Washington Heights, named for Booker T. Washington. As far as I know, the first and only Black streetcar suburb in the United States. Mm. And so that became a sort of a middle-class enclave. And then West Charlotte High School, which was originally in the building that is now Northwest School of the Arts.
We're going to talk some more about streetcars later on in this program here with Senator Malcolm Graham, Mary Newsom, and Tom Hanchett. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Clayworks, a home for ceramic arts and artists in Charlotte, now registering for beginner through advanced 6 and 10-week winter classes. Details at learnclay.com. And Wilson Engineering Service, offering biomass energy project development, EPA boiler mat compliance, and energy assessment services to industrial and commercial clients. WilsonEngineeringServices.com. Well, we all know that for just about everything, there's an app for that. These are apps for weather, for news, sports, dating, games, dining, getting a ride someplace. WFAE has apps for iPhone and for Android. And there are two brand new apps that have been created right here in Charlotte. One to socialize, the other to shop. We talk about how they work, what users are looking for in apps today, and more with some app developers tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Russian ruble is sliding despite a rate hike by the Russian Central Bank. What falling oil prices and a weakened ruble mean for the Kremlin and the Russian economy.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. Here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Ronald Carter, who is the president of Johnson C. Smith University, had an idea to put together an anthology, a book about Charlotte's West Side, and he gathered journalists and civic leaders and historians and others to contribute essays to this. It's called Let There Be Light, Exploring How Charlotte's Historic West End is Shaping a New South. And three of the, I think, 13 people who have contributed to this are with us today. Tom Hanchett, the historian of the Levine Museum of the New South. Mary Newsom, associate director of Urban and Regional Affairs with UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute, who is on vacation today and with us anyway. Thank you. And Senator Malcolm Graham, who's also a special assistant to the president at JCSU. Let's fast forward to today. We've been talking about history, but I can't get an answer to the question when all this began to happen, when suddenly this mixed neighborhood became the other side, the black side of town. And Dr. Carter writes about this stark division in his foreword to this book. He says the abrupt borderline that marks the boundary between Charlotte's two very different worlds is not just physical, it's mental. And he writes that he was really disturbed when no one could clearly tell him how or why this division had occurred. And it seems to me we can't do it either, can we?
It's true. I tell the story that when I first got here in 1981 as a freshman at Johnson C. Smith University, there was no Ballantyne, there was no University City, there was no Panthers or Hornets. It was wrestling and racing, and the celebrity in town was in Cam Newton. It was Ric Flair and Wahoo McDaniel and Richard Petty. Going to UNCC was going to the country. Mm-hmm. The city has evolved since then, but what remains the same, if you would take a picture of West Trey Street, Batesford Road in 1981 and compare it to today, although the city has changed in leaps and bounds, there's a thriving Ballantyne. University City is a great edge community. South Boulevard is growing in leaps and bounds. In 1981, the Marriott Hotel was under construction, and on the corner where the Corporate Center sits was the Eckers Drugstore, the Burger King, the pawn shop. So the city has exploded in growth, exploded in development, except West Trey Street, Batesford Road, and perhaps the west side of the city.
You were at the newspaper, were you not, in those years or shortly after those years?
For many of those years, yeah.
Okay, so now South Boulevard, for people who don't know what the South End, our fancy South End, was just a few years ago, it was urban blight. How would you describe it?
I would not describe it as blight. Just
it was horrible.
It depends on one's point of view. But to see what South Boulevard looked like, if you go south of the Scaly Bark light rail stop, it was a lot of that.
All the more abandoned warehouse factory situation.
A lot of old factory buildings. Now, some of us see old factory buildings and don't see blight. We see opportunity.
Yes.
And I think that actually, I think that's going to happen on the West Trade Street and Batesford Road corridor. As more and more people want to live in the city and they want to live in cool, funky, gritty places, mm-hmm. I think those buildings that for many years sat kind of neglected are going to become very valuable places.
Well, you know, and I guess that's a good way to describe South End up to a point, cool, funky, gritty. But now that they've built 10,000 apartments, brand new apartments, is it still cool, funky, and gritty? Has the grit been removed, essentially?
I'm not in the age demographic that is going to be defining cool, funky, gritty. However, I think there's other places in town that have more of that.
And is that what, and I noticed in the book, you refer to the West Side as the West End. Is that what the West End wants to become, cool, funky, gritty?
Well, I think we want to become a part of the fabric of the city. This is a growing community, and we see no growth. And when Dr. Carter got here and brought me in to be as a special assistant to work primarily towards revitalizing the community over there, we had a big, tall task ahead of us. Mm-hmm. That bridge was a demarcation factor that you did not go underneath the I-77 bridge. And we had to change that. And so we worked tirelessly with the Indaba, which is the Councils of Elders, that talked about the past and the history of the community. And then we plotted a growth forward.
I have to stop you. You said Indaba, mm-hmm. and that was a word I ran across in the book that I'd never heard before.
Mm-hmm.
Say it again. What is the Indaba, and who's part of this?
The Indaba is an African phrase that Dr. Carter brought with him to Johnson C. Smith University. It's basically defined as the Council of Elders. And so we assemble community leaders up and down the West End community, mm-hmm. Macquarie Heights, Washington Heights, all those who had a stake in building a better community, and got their feedback, their opinions about how do we change this community in a positive type of way, respecting the history, but knowing that we had to kind of plow forward and make positive changes.
Tom talked about in his essay that Johnson C. Smith University being the taproot of development and success, and in making that part of what I guess was just a hilltop, an unpopulated hilltop, the thriving area that it became after 1870 when the university was built, or the college at the time was built. And Dr. Carter, when he came in, and we did an interview with him when he first arrived in Charlotte on this program. And you, I think, write in your essay, Senator Graham, that the previous occupant of that office was inward-looking. He was focused on the college. And when Dr. Carter arrived, and he said this on the show, he was going to be outward-focused. He was going to be bringing the community to the college and the college to the community, and seeing where there were synergies and seeing how the college could provoke growth and development. And we've seen a lot of that from that bridge to the college right now, because you've got the Mosaic apartment complex, you've got the art center, you've got the art project that bridge has become, particularly at night, mm-hmm. with the lighting. And that's all due to this new approach. He goes on in his essay to say, if we do not understand how a significant part of our city was at best simply ignored and neglected, or at worst deliberately made to remain poor so that other parts could thrive, there is no way we can stop the process or make sure that it doesn't happen again. What is the consensus? Was the West Side ignored or deliberately made to remain poor so that areas like Ballantyne and University City could exist? And two people on this panel are vigorously nodding their heads, Mary and Tom.
Well, I think it. You just watch the development tracks. The development went to where the money was, and I think Tom mentioned earlier in his comments that even back going way back in the day, that development followed power and money and influence. And obviously, the influence was making sure that Charlotte had a vibrant uptown community. Although Johnson C. Smith and West End is literally less than 2 miles away, that the South End and remember Eastland Mall used to be the big mall in the city, and then the growth went towards the south side of town. That was particularly important. The city put utilities towards University City, so the growth went that way. So where the infrastructure and where the political bodies put the their positioning in terms of what their priorities was, the West End was never a priority. And so the resources, the money, the influence followed the priorities, and West End was never really thought of as a priority.
So I want to hear from Tom and Mary about this too.
It's deeply rooted in history. In the 1930s, the federal government wanted to help the national mortgage market rebound from the Depression. And so they drew red lines around bad neighborhoods, green lines around good neighborhoods, hoping to stimulate.
Bad being what? What was the
neighborhoods
definition?
With undesirable social or economic groups. That's
okay.
what they
All
said.
Right. All right.
And it was – they weren't trying to disrespect those neighborhoods. They were trying to get money going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So it went to green neighborhoods in on the redlining map. And those were not neighborhoods with African Americans. So that's one kind of federal signal, government signal that, hey, private lending market – you know, you really shouldn't be putting money into those neighborhoods. You end up with a lot of absentee landlords.
Mm.
Some absentee landlords are fine folks, but having a neighborhood mostly with absentee landlords is a neighborhood that is at risk. When I came to Charlotte in 1981, the big news on the west side was that the city government had finally put in sidewalks.
Mm-hmm.
And David Goldfield, the great urban historian at UNC Charlotte, says, you know, back in the day, if you wanted to find the black side of town, you didn't need to look for the people, just look for where the city services end. And you have all of that stuff happening cumulatively. You know, it's bad enough by itself, but then it sends a signal to somebody who is about to go buy or rent or invest, and they go, well, maybe a different part of town would be better for my money.
I want to hear from Mary on this, the deliberate nature of making the West Side remain poor.
I think part of it was absolutely blatant discriminatory policies at the federal, state, and local level. As Tom has described, you could do a whole program on that factor itself
mm-hmm.
In the way Charlotte has developed.
And every American city.
And every American city, not just Charlotte. But then you layer onto that the more personal cultural discrimination against African Americans. If I had been looking for a house in a tree-lined neighborhood with brick bungalows in 1980 and had asked a real realtor to show me those houses, that realtor would not have taken me to Wesley Heights.
Would not have.
Would not have.
Definitely
to Wesley Heights
have.
Or Seversville, because those were African American neighborhoods and they just assumed white people didn't want to live there, and by and large they were right.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the political policy infrastructure, you've got the cultural expectation infrastructure, and then you've got the free market. If you're a developer and you want to do a development, number one, it's much easier to do it on Greenfield. Number two, you look at your marketing formulas, and the marketing formulas look at household income. And that knocks out a lot of low-income and African-American neighborhoods right there. So you've got a matrix of mm-hmm. all kinds of things. And then you've got a city government that pays attention to the powerful.
Senator Graham, you write about seeing this neglect as a college student. You came here from Charleston, and you write about being able to walk through the city streets of Charleston and go to shops and coffee places and mm-hmm. lunch counters, and all of that was convenient to the College of Charleston, which
mm-hmm.
it is. And you write about how the city, when you got here, was working on something called Project Catalyst.
Mm-hmm.
The city adopted that project. It's a West Side redevelopment plan in 1988, and then put it on the shelf. Why are they adopted in that case, and were any of the elements of that plan ever implemented?
No. I am certain, as a former council member, I hadn't seen the room, but I'm almost certain that there is a room in City Hall where old plans go to die. And we come up with these great plans, and they sound good. We bring people together, and then we put it in a room, and it dies. And that was one of the things that Dr. Carter definitely wanted to do. He didn't want to plan. He wanted to implement.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was enough planning documents. And so we got with Deborah Campbell, who was then the planning director, and we kind of brushed off some of the West Side Strategic Plan, which was another plan, Project Catalyst, which was another plan, all adopted by the city, but never really fully implemented, and began the process of slowly but surely implementing phases of it. We did our own plan, too. We had to do a ULI, Urban Land Institute, plan, and we began by revitalizing the old Griffin Tire Company into the arts center.
Right.
We took it a step further and did Mosaic Village, which is a 10,000 square feet of retail, 80 suite style apartments with a whole 400 students. We did Passing Through Lights, which is the underneath the I-77 bridge project to revitalize that area. We wanted to make it closer to putting the university investment in there.
But you also talk about something that I don't know that white people have ever thought about. You talk about how there was a time at Johnson C. Smith where students kind of hunkered down inside the gates of the campus because they didn't feel safe walking out.
Exactly. We used to – I was a student there from 81, 85, and we used to huddle inside the dormitory and find out who's going to make the Bojangles run. That's from – that's right by the bridge.
I mean, that's horrible.
Who's going to make the run? And because it really wasn't a safe area. So the university for so long encouraged – that the students and the faculty and the staff, we remained behind the gates, and we never went outside the gates. And that type of mindset lasted, from my opinion, far too long. Because as we said earlier, Johnson C. Smith is the anchor institution for that community.
So you're trying to change that, but you still write, somebody in one of their essays, because I read them, wrote about the fact that this is still a part of town where people who don't live there and who are just driving through maybe to get from West Trade 85 do it as quickly as possible, usually in the daytime, with their doors locked. So there's still that impression that this, you do not want to get out of your car.
And that today is more perception than reality in terms of the safety of that community is probably one of the safest areas in the city if you look at some of the crime stats from the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. So we're still finding there's a perception area, and it's because it's the visual of what you see. Again, if you would take that picture from 81 to today, a lot has not changed except that some of the businesses that were open in 1981 when I came here are now closed. And that's why it's so important that the university begin this forward thinking of investing. And the university over the last 4 years has invested over $25 million of infrastructure on the west side, specifically in our definition for our revitalization is from the I-77 bridge to the historically Excelsior's Club. That's what we're trying to kind of focus in terms of the development, what I call a chewable bite.
How much of that perception is – go ahead, Tom.
And there's a national trend that Johnson C. Smith is positioning itself to ride on a wave of interest among younger people in returning to the city. The notion of diversity, which we now think of as a good thing, was not a good thing when I was growing up, that recently. People who are younger than me now more take for granted, it's not perfect, but much more that they will live with people who are different than themselves and that that's a good kind of adventure and that living in an older part of the city is also a good adventure. You can see those changes going on around Johnson C. Smith.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Urban Institute studies this kind of thing, doesn't it?
We do a lot of demographic work.
So what is responsible for this shift in opinion that diversity suddenly is something I want to be part of?
You can't really tell that by looking at census statistics. Mm-hmm. I use the technical term zeitgeist. It's what's kind of out in the air at the time. And if going back to what Malcolm was saying about what you were saying about the 1980s, 70s and 80s, nationally people were terrified of cities. There'd been a whole generation of cultural pressure to go to the suburbs. Mm-hmm. Cities were bad. Suburbs were good. Mm-hmm. You couldn't even get a federal loan to fix up your house if it was in a city. So you had the whole cultural zeitgeist. Cities were bad. Cities were dangerous. Go to the suburbs. They're safe and clean. And I think there's just, people like to not do what their parents did. And young people, they figured out cities are pretty cool and interesting and fun.
Yeah. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk some more about this. I want to talk about the streetcar, too, because there's an interesting comment about the streetcar in this book that people need to think about and chew on. Also, if you are on Twitter, what do you think area leaders should do to continue to reshape the West Side in a way that honors its history? You can send us your comments on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE, and we are coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings, LLP, a full-service law firm advising financial institutions and investors in all types of capital markets and lending transactions. Details at babc.com. And Sharon Luggage, offering holiday gifts for casual and business travelers, luggage, wallets, and travel accessories with two locations, Shops on the Park and Arrowwood. Travel resources at sharonluggage.com. Well, the Russian ruble is sliding, falling precipitously, despite a rate hike by the Russian Central Bank. And Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about what falling oil prices and the new U.S. sanctions mean for the Kremlin and the Russian economy. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, we're going to continue our conversation about Charlotte's West Side or West End. And if you'd like to join us, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
As 2014 draws to a close, we want to thank you for listening to and supporting WFAE. Please make your tax-deductible donation. Call 704-549-9000 or make your gift online at WFAE.org. Donate by midnight on December 21st, and you'll automatically be entered to win an Apple iPad Mini. No pledge is necessary, but we hope you'll support WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mary Newsom is with us. She's the Associate Director of Urban and Regional Affairs at the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. Tom Hanchett is the historian at the Levine Museum of the New South. And Senator Malcolm Graham is also Special Assistant to the President of Johnson C. Smith University, Dr. Ronald Carter, who gathered together journalists and historians and civic leaders and others to contribute to a book called Let There Be Light, Exploring How Charlotte's Historic West End is Shaping a New South. The purpose of the book is to teach about history of the area, but also to begin a discussion about what it is and what it could be and what the vision for it ought to be going forward, because Dr. Carter is very focused on revitalization of that area and making the university the fulcrum of that, if that's the right word to use, of that revitalization. Sheila emails, if Dr. Carter ever decided to enter the political arena, he has my vote. Last spring, he spoke at the main library and presented not only the problems of having a city of haves and have-nots, but he offered real common sense solutions. That is so rare these days that people identify the issues and how to address them. You want to comment on that since you work with Dr. Carter?
I think he is an excellent leader. I think he's a great visionary in terms of for the community. And certainly, I mean, if you would imagine, and me, Mary took a tour about 4 years ago, and I was telling Mary all the things we wanted to do. She's probably thought it would take us 10 years to get it done, and we got it done in probably about 4 years.
Wow.
So I call him Microwave because he likes things done quickly, and we've demonstrated that there's an appetite for the type of change that's needed in the community. So I certainly love working with him.
Kenneth emails, you were discussing people moving due to blacks moving into their neighborhood. I can remember in 1975, our family lived on Sylvania Avenue between Tryon and Graham, about 18 blocks from the center of the city. We moved from there to the Cotswold area, and I was later told that it was because blacks had taken over our old neighborhood. Ancient history, one hopes. Greg on Twitter, can you discuss becoming part of the fabric of the city while resisting gentrification, which is something we do want to get into.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, can communities that are there now thrive without the displacement of people by others looking for grit and character and actually turning the grit and character that exists there into something completely different, taking a bungalow and turning it into a 5,000-square-foot, three-story home, which is happening in other parts of the city? Mm-hmm. Mary, talk about that.
Gentrification is one of those really tricky terms that means something different to different people. I'm going to use the term to mean rapid change that increases the income level in a neighborhood and causes displacement of people who would prefer to stay there. And I think that the West End is threatened by gentrification. There's a lot of homes being renovated there right now, which is a good thing.
New homes being built.
New homes being built. The area is diversifying. It used to be almost exclusively African-American. It's now much more diverse. And I think those are good developments, especially when it happens slowly and organically.
But is it what people who live there want? Because a lot of those people will be displaced.
We've had this conversation over the number of years when we started with our ULI study and bringing in the Council of Elders, the Indaba, and talking to community leaders. We want positive change, and we don't want the residents who are currently there to be victims of it. And that's a delicate balancing act.
Yeah. So can you control that? Is that something that
there's
can
a
be?
Great model already in Wesley Heights that Mary's been talking about. Judge Shirley Fulton, who was one of the first African-American judges in this area, many years ago said, I need to live close to the court. Where can I live? Oh, wait a minute. Look at this place. And moved in.
Do you like the trees, if I read correctly?
Beautiful trees. Yeah. The Wadsworth Estate is a grand old farmhouse in the middle, arts and crafts, and she bought that and renovated it as a community center, but mostly worked with folks in the neighborhood, the older African-American homeowners who had moved because of the displacement of urban renewal, the young families that were moving in. And I've gone several years to talk at their Christmas party, and it is everybody all together. Mm-hmm. That neighborhood has gone through considerable change without alienating folks who've been there. At least that's what I see when I go visit.
I think one key thing that has helped Wesley Heights stay comparatively stable and maintain its character is that it's a historic district. It's a local historic district and a National Register historic district. The other neighborhoods in that area are not. Mm-hmm. That gives them some protection from someone who's just coming in and demolishing the old bungalows and building a gigantic modernist house. Not complete protection, but some.
One of the things that we're trying to encourage through a concept that we're working on now for a community development corporation called Smith Square, we really want to begin to work with millennials, those students who go to Smith and Johnson & Wales, UNCC, et cetera, to help us plan out the community because we're going into a different phase now. Mm-hmm. A plan a community that they want to live, work, and play in. So we want to work with young students, black, white, whatever, Asian, Latino, about working together and planning a community that they want to be a part of.
How do you deal with the poverty that exists on the West Side? There are a lot of people who live there not because they're black, because they're poor, and that's what they can afford. So as you gentrify an area and the real estate values start rising, those people generally have to leave because landlords, property owners, etc., want to maximize their investment. So where do they go? Because we already have a shortage of public, of affordable workforce housing.
Mike, if I can answer that question or any of my panelists, we would be going across the country touring.
Surely that's crossed your mind. Surely crossed Dr. Carter's mind.
Every day. And the same thing is happening, whether you're looking at the Belmont community.
But you're driving it. I mean, you could leave it the way it is. And, those people would be there.
No, we clearly understand that. And part of it is the support of education initiatives like Project Live. Again, making sure that people are part of the change and not victims of it by working with home buyers, seminars and counseling, credit counseling, job readiness, employment opportunities. I mean, so the university has to do more than obviously just help revitalize the community, but we have to engage and partner with other institutions in terms of do all those supportive services necessary to build a community. And so we're doing all those things as well. It's a very, very tricky question to answer. And not only are we dealing with it on the West End, but, as a former council member working with Deborah Campbell and the Planning Commission, we had the same type of issue that we dealt with within Belmont and Optimist Park and Villa Heights, which is another edge community right next to Uptown. A lot of people, as you indicated, want to live in Uptown Charlotte. They can't afford to do so. So they want to live in the edge community. I mean, so whether it's Johnson C. Smith, Belmont, and now, as you indicated, going down North Tryon Street, which is going to be another edge community that's getting ready to rapidly grow. And right. What we want to do is expand the boundaries of Uptown Charlotte and expand it three ways.
Well, we have to because we're now landlocked.
We're landlocked.
We cannot annex any more property. And if we don't want taxes to rise outrageously, we have to develop land and increase the property values and the tax values of those inbound, locked-in areas.
Exactly.
That's part of it.
Exactly. And so, the developers really don't have any choices anymore because
right.
they have to come west. And we believe that the West Side community is really, really prime and ready for growth. And as I indicated earlier, the university have already plowed $24 million on the ground. We want to leverage our investment with private developers and others to come to the community to help us build it. And government, the city government, has a role to play in that as well. And, as a former council member who was vice chairman of the Economic Development Committee, who authored the West Side Strategic Plan, we got to put public investment on the West Side, which is that's a great debate. Going back to the streetcar, as we talked about earlier.
So. Well, let's talk about this. Let's talk about the streetcar. Dr. Carter brings this up in his essay or his foreword to the book. He says, opponents often contend that the streetcar will be a waste of money, that the results would not be worth the investment. Why isn't the West Side and the equally marginalized East Charlotte side worth it, he asks. Where did that attitude come from? Now, there were a lot of people prior to the opening of the Lynx Blue Line who were adamantly opposed to it and had dire predictions of its failure. They were proven wrong. But that opposition was based on economics, I think. The opposition to the streetcar, Dr. Carter seems to be saying, is based on race and ethnicity, because it will run from the West Side through the East Side over to Eastland Mall, two areas that have been neglected, two areas that are racially and ethnically diverse. Is what he's saying right? Is the opposition racially and ethnically based?
I think there's an argument to be made that it is. I mean, again, those two-sided towns have been so neglected for so many years. The streetcar is infrastructure, and I think if we have the opportunity to revitalize the corridor, mm-hmm. we begin to revitalize the communities around it.
Will people on the West Side ride that streetcar, and to what end?
The number 7 bus is probably one of the highest ridership bus in the city, so the streetcar will replace the bus service that's currently there. We'll begin to revitalize that corridor by bringing shops and restaurants and those type of entities to the community. You do that, then you begin to revitalize the neighborhoods around them.
You agree with that, Tom?
The South End is a really good example of how investment in infrastructure attracts private investment. All of those apartments and condominiums that are now marching down South Boulevard did not happen just because somebody waved a wand. They happened because that infrastructure investment in the Lynx Blue Line.
Well, yes, the rail, you can move a bus. If you're not getting traffic along South Boulevard, then put the bus someplace else. But you can't move the rail. Is the same true of a streetcar?
That's true.
It will bring the same kind. You think it will bring the same kind of development that the rail line?
You're asking a historian to predict the future. I predict the past.
Well, I can tell you. Is past performance any indication of that? Then?
I can tell you that the original streetcar was built in the 1890s by a fellow that had a bunch of vacant land out south of the city named Edward Dilworth Latta, mm-hmm. and he built that streetcar where there was no market for it, and it became Dilworth.
But didn't they build those streetcars back then in part to make use of the electric power that was being generated by electric companies when they were still trying to build people's interest in electricity? Isn't that part of it?
That was one of the pieces. So the streetcars have never purely been transportation. They always are infrastructure that is intended to have spin-off investments. And I've been amazed, as a historian, to watch what's going on in the South End, because it's recapitulating that history in such an exciting way. Yeah. And so it makes the argument that building a streetcar to the East Side and West Side will attract investment there as well.
So we posed this question on Twitter and Facebook. What do you think area leaders should do to continue to reshape the West Side? Here's some of the answers we're getting. Jay on Twitter says, don't cross 77. I definitely heard that as a Johnson and Wales freshman in 2008. Greg on Twitter, stimulate neighborhood growth while resisting gentrification, displacement of poor residents will not honor the history of the West Side. That's a sticky wicket, isn't it? Patrick on Twitter, should Johnson C. Smith still be fenced in or physically open itself up to the neighborhood? Now, there's an interesting question.
That's a conversation we have on campus at the administrative level, at the highest level.
So that's a possibility?
I think it's a conversation the universities have had.
Leave the historic gate up and take the fences down, maybe?
That's a possibility.
Jay on Facebook, the sad thing is we still continue to treat the West Side today as if it is still the bad side to live on, but yet somehow NoDa was better. Talk about how we chose which neighborhoods get revitalized and which don't. NoDa is an interesting example of this. Mary.
NoDa benefited by two things that I don't think the West Side has had yet. Number one was an intact commercial Main Street built as the Main Street for the old mill village that was there. And that provides a sense of place that, frankly, you don't have much of along West Trade Street and Betty's Ford Road, where things are more farther apart. Number two, it had a couple of artists that just bought a building and said, hey, let's open some galleries. And I think that – that's the kind of individual investment that the West End
And the third thing that it had, and I'm not patting myself on the back, it had political leadership. And I was the district representative in District 4 in 1999 when NODAL was just getting started. And we advocated for NODAL. We advocated for Belmont, Villa Heights, Optimist Park as an edge community.
And surely you advocated for the West Side at the same time, and it didn't happen there.
Well, you know, I was that was not my district. And I advocated for NODA.
Okay.
And so, you know, where the political leadership puts its muscle and its influence, things seem to happen. Obviously, I advocated for the whole city, but
there's never one single entity who says this will happen.
Yeah.
There's a sense, I think, in America that, you know, they decide that NODA is going to thrive, or they decide that the West – there is no they.
But in reality, Tom, and you're a historian.
Relative small
for a long
steps.
Time, that is exactly what happened in this city. They, the seven white guys who ran the town, did make those decisions.
But I don't think the seven white guys said, oh hey, let's celebrate NODA. That was completely under their radar.
Yeah,
it was organic, mm-hmm. And the community wanted change. Because NODA was pretty rough too back in the 90s. They wanted change. There was a commercial district that was trying to get off its feet. And there was someone around the dais that the council was giving them who had their back, if I can use that analogy.
Right. Comment from Facebook, why do we allow the label of historic homes only on the south end? There are lots of historical homes and buildings on the west side that should get it be invested into. Can you discuss whether anyone's trying to get historic status on any homes or buildings on the west side?
One of the writers in Let There Be Light is John Howard, who is the historic district administrator for the city. He points out that there are about a dozen individual landmarks, the historic Excelsior Club, the Best Waterworks, individual houses. And it would be great if McCrory Heights, that beautiful 1950s upper-income suburb, became our first mid-20th century historic district.
So West End is used throughout this book. It's in the title of Let There Be Light, exploring how Charlotte's historic West End is shaping a new South. Is that what you want us to call the West Side from now on, the West End?
Yeah, West End works for me. And one of the things that we're going to do is talk about branding opportunities for the West End and opening up to the public because, again, we believe this is the new edge community.
State Senator Malcolm Graham, Special Assistant to the President of Johnson C. Smith University, Mary Newsom, Associate Director of Urban and Regional Affairs for the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute, and Tom Hanchett, historian at the Levine Museum of the New South, all contributed to the book Let There Be Light. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.